Welcome back to Putting It Together, the podcast that discusses Stephen Sondheim's entire body of work chronologically, show by show, and song by song. This week is going to be a bit different, as there are no lyrics to speak of. That's because we're discussing the song The Dance at the Gym. This is West Side Story, a show that is as much about dance as it is about music and lyrics. So for this episode, we are going to discuss the dance movement specifically. To do that, I invited on local dance instructor and choreographer Christopher Duxbury. I've known Christopher for a while since he joined as a member of a local video creators group I'm part of. He was able to lend his expertise to something I am an absolute Luddite on. If you do have access to the movie version of West Side Story and have the means to watch it while listening to this episode, I think you should absolutely do that. We'll give you instructions of where to start later in this episode. But for now, let's jump into that conversation I had with Christopher about The Dance at the Gym from West Side Story. All right, Christopher Duxbury, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. I think this is where we need to start. Why don't you introduce yourself?
I think that is a good place to start. My name is Christopher Duxbury. I am the owner and creator of the Christopher Duxbury Dance Collective, which is a dance company here in Calgary. And yeah, I've been dancing pretty much my entire life and working in social media and all of the fun stuff.
All that fun stuff.
All of the fun stuff.
What type of relationship, if any, do you have with Stephen Sondheim?
Well, obviously I grew up in musical theater, so I've fallen in love with pretty much everything that Sondheim has done. And personally, I don't have too much musical theater in my own company right now, but I grew up West Side Story, everything Sondheim.
I'm curious when you started to become fascinated by dancing.
Actually, when I started dancing, I was kind of encouraged to do it by somebody else. I had no interest in it whatsoever. My mother had been a dancer a little bit when she was younger, and she taught me how to do a little bit of ballroom here and there. But I was more of, it's weird, you would never guess it now, but I was more of a sports kid.
Really?
I loved volleyball. I played every single day. I loved soccer quite a bit. And then I had a gym teacher who told me that he could see that I kind of lit up when I did dance. And we had like a dance session in our gym classes. And he took me up to the side and said, I know that you love volleyball, but you don't glow as much as you do when you dance. So maybe it's something you should look into. And like 2 days later, I took my first dance class and just changed everything.
So. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, dancing was the part where I always hated that they brought it up in gym class. I didn't like anything in gym. So it was like, that was par for the course, I suppose. What was it about dancing though? Can you verbalize it? Like what was it that you like so much?
The way that I talk about it when I'm talking to somebody who doesn't understand performing art is there's only so much you can say. There's a lot of things that you can feel that you just don't have the words for. And like, even if you're trying to learn a second language, sometimes there's not a word in English that you would see in like Japanese or whatever. So sometimes I'm just feeling something that I can't necessarily talk about. So if I can dance it out, then I also get the frustrations or the excitements, and I get to put something into them other than just speaking, which can seem kind of flat and empty. But I've always really just appreciated the idea that our ability to communicate doesn't stop at sound. It can continue into movement and feeling. And that's always made me just love it.
So that very first dance class, if you can cast your memory back to that point, what did you learn in that first class?
It's ridiculous. It was supposed to be a hip-hop class.
Uh-huh.
Now, as a trained and competitive hip-hop dancer, I would have asked for my money back.
It was actually polka is what they learned.
We spent the entire class rolling like pencils across the floor.
Wow.
And I was hooked. It was a horrible class, but I remember the teacher just had such a fantastic energy, and she was so funny. She was so funny. And I, every time I did something, it didn't matter that I was rolling across the floor like somebody tossing a hot dog down a hill. Like, anything she said at all, I was just so excited to do because she just loved the fact that she was helping kids dance. And that's the thing I like more. Like, I enjoy dancing more than anything in the world, but I love when people want to be there. Mm-hmm. I love finding a way to get people to want to be there. That was one of the best classes, but it was one of the worst learning experiences ever.
Interesting.
So, I am now a hot dog.
That'll be the tagline for this episode. Yeah. I am a hot dog. I mean, you mentioned how the teacher noticed that you lit up while you were performing dancing. I wish there was a visual component to this podcast, because I can definitely tell that you will light up when you're even speaking about dancing.
But see, that's even one of the things about it is we wish that there was a visual aspect to it, but now you have to try to find a way to describe it.
That's like, right.
I just love it that we hit the microphone. I just love the fact that we have to try to find new ways to communicate. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's so much fun.
So, I mean, you've essentially grown into then owning your own studio.
Not my own studio, my own company.
Your own company,
yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
So tell me about your company.
The tagline of my company is helping you find your spark. Mm-hmm. And I find that for a lot of people, dance is sort of what they're either running toward or what they're running away from. It's like they go to dance because they're running toward something or running away from something. And that makes it an escape. And, you know, and we all have these just busy lives, and adults always have to be going and going and going. Anybody out there who has ever watched an episode of Grey's Anatomy will remember the term, the carousel never stops turning.
Right,
you
right.
Know, you can't get off of it, but for an hour a day, for an hour a week, in most people's cases, you can just stop being an adult. Mm-hmm. You can just let yourself do something that really ultimately in the long run doesn't necessarily change the world, but it fixes yours for a moment. You know?
Yeah.
I've always really loved that. And that's what my company is about. It's about giving people a healthy escape. I try to make sure that if you come in and you're having a lesson with me, you're spending the entire time realizing that it's not about perfection, and it's not about ever getting somewhere. It's about the journey on your way. I never care about the destination. I always care about the journey.
What's your favorite part about teaching?
The aha.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I love working with somebody who's been in a lesson or in classes with me for years, and I can work on one pattern with them and they just can't get it. And then the one time I change my metaphors and
right.
They go, oh, like that. And I love that feeling. I love seeing the spark behind people's eyes when they figure out something that they've been working for. Mm-hmm. Melts my heart every time.
This is a very particular question. Is there a song you love dancing to the most?
Actually, I love that you asked that. I've never had somebody ask me that question before. I'm choreographing, I've just finished actually, a cover of the song Firestone.
Okay.
And it's sung by a singer named Beth, and it's one of the most musically beautiful pieces I've ever heard. And just the way that she arranged her vocals is, it's one of the most fantastic covers ever, and I can't listen to it without moving. So
right.
If I listen to it on the train, I'll look up and people will be looking at me because I didn't realize I've been dancing the entire time.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
I mean, because I'm such a fan of musical theater, I get that sense. I never felt that I was a very good dancer, and that's probably because kids are always told not to do things, or they're told they're bad at something at a young age.
Or because you didn't have me as your teacher.
Right, that's partly true. But anytime I see like just a show where I'm like watching the Tony Awards or something each year, and I just like that band comes on and like
yeah.
You see these amazing people doing like high kicks. I'm like, that's amazing. I wish I could do that. I feel like I want to join them. Mm-hmm. Like I'd have no idea what I was doing trying to be there. I just want to be a Rockette is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And I feel the same way. If you go to a Broadway show or watch an award show, as soon as the curtains open and the performers start, just the look on their faces of how effortless they make it, but you can tell it took everything, and you feel like, I could probably do that, and then you try to kick, and you fall over. It's just, it's wonderful. That's one of my favorite things about being a dancer, is by doing it, I love that other people feel like they could do it, and it encourages them to try.
Yeah.
I love it. So,
one thing before we transition into talking about West Side Story is, the one thing that Stephen Sondheim is known for is writing lyrics that match the character. He's very big on being like, the character, if he wouldn't say this, is not going to sing it either.
Absolutely.
So he really wants to make sure that hits. For choreography for yourself, is that something that you think about? Like, making sure people are actually moving in a way that they would for that character that they're performing?
Absolutely, yeah. One of my favorite sayings, actually, there's a girl who has written out a book of Christopher's rules. Mm-hmm. And rule number one is make the music make sense.
Okay.
So for me, that can mean absolutely anything. If I'm choreographing a piece and I want to focus on accents, I'm going to spend the entire time listening to the parts that catch your attention and everyone's attention. So I'll put on a song really loudly, and if one part catches everyone's attention and they all bob their heads at the same time, I know that's what I want to choreograph. Or if it's a song that the lyrics make me cry, I'm going to dance the entire thing lyrically, and I'm going to tell a story almost like the I'm a Little Teapot syndrome.
Right.
Just dance it exactly as it's being said. But yeah, absolutely, as a choreographer, it's my job and my pleasure to make sure that I'm making the music make more sense. And I love trying to find something in a really popular song that maybe people didn't notice was in the music before and make it stand out even more.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now I want to see like a hip hop version of I'm a Little Teapot.
Oh, you just gave me such a great challenge. It's on its way.
It's on its way.
Yeah.
We've already discussed here in previous episodes just how beautiful the actual music is. Yeah. But what we haven't had a lot of chance to do is really delve into the dance and the why behind the dance yet, which is why I decided to invite you here, because I thought you would know a whole lot about it. In fact, right from Finishing the Hat, that book that I keep referencing here in these episodes, how Sondheim actually opens up his talk about West Side Story is by saying, for most people, West Side Story is about racial prejudice and urban violence, but what it's really about is theater, musical theater to be more precise. It's about the blending of book, music, lyrics, and most importantly, dance into the seamless telling of a story. So we get to talk today about specifically that dance in the gym. And there's obviously other dance sequences that happen in this musical, but the first one that comes up is this fabled dance where Tony and Maria first meet one another. So we left off last episode with the song Something's Coming. And from Wikipedia, Maria works in a bridal shop with Anita, that's who we meet next, and the girlfriend of her brother, Bernardo. Maria has just arrived from Puerto Rico for her arranged marriage to Chino, a friend of Bernardo's. Maria confesses to Anita that she is not in love with Chino, and Anita makes Maria dress to wear to the neighborhood dance. And then at the dance, after introductions, the teenagers begin to dance, and soon a challenge dance is called. And that's kind of what we're going to be discussing here today. And if you want to follow in at home, this is how we're going to actually structure this. We're going to actually be watching the movie on silent, of course. You won't actually hear that, and there's not going to be no copyright strikes against me. But we're going to be kind of following along, and we'll pause if we need to here and there. But we are starting here at the 31 minute and 57 second mark. If you are watching this either on iTunes or the DVD or Blu-ray copy that you happen to have, is very nicely, we know it's from the 1960s because we have this nice psychedelic transition from Maria spinning.
Instantly. It's an acid trip at the beginning.
That's right. Someone dropped some really like acid Kool-Aid and then we're into the dance sequence here. So we're going to watch these people kind of doing their moves here. Now, what we're seeing here right now, Christopher, you have like these really like huge movements going on.
Yeah, everything's very, people. Very modern. Everything is really tall and Everyone's trying to take up a lot of space. Yeah.
Is there any like why behind that? Like when you're choreographing something or when you're actually using those types of movements, is that supposed to represent anything at all?
A lot of the time in musical theater, when you're taking up a lot of space like that, the taller you get, the more you're trying to claim space. Mm. So throughout this entire movie, actually, you'll see that quite a bit. Even when they're just walking down the street, they'll open their arms as wide as they can. It's kind of a, this is my space feeling.
Right,
and the taller they get, the more they're just trying to be seen. The more they're trying to say that, I'm the one who you should have your eyes on. And if you can't be as tall as me, if you can't be as seen as me, then maybe you shouldn't be here.
Right. Which really makes a whole lot of sense as we have like these two gangs essentially trying to like have dominance over one another and really trying to make sure like they are the ones who are claiming that space over the other one.
Yeah. And you kind of hear throughout the entire thing that the Jeds are talking about how the space that they have isn't very big, mm-hmm. but it is their space.
Right.
So they're trying to make the most of the space that they have by making themselves seem bigger.
Right. So now we have, if you're still watching on the movie here, we have Maria entering here to the school dance, looking around of what's going on, and of course being ushered into the fray by Bernardo here. And then things are going to stop here in just a moment as we see these two kind of ideas clashing in on one another. I'm curious for you, being part of musical theater and stuff like that, how do you go about choreographing something, meaning like, is this something where you're bringing students in and then figuring out together, or are you actually like, no, this is all done in my mind before I even start?
For me personally, it really depends on if I'm choreographing something that has already existed once and I'm kind of revamping it. If I'm revamping a piece that already exists, then I like to just do that on my own. I think that I like to pay an homage to the original pieces of whatever I've choreographed and just try to blend a new feeling and make it a little bit more modern. If I'm choreographing a completely new piece, it's really going to depend on who I'm choreographing it for. There are a lot of musical theater choreographers who need their dancers there to see what their bodies can do and what it does for the character, especially with characters that were created specifically for the people playing them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I found something out only very recently as far as like musical theater goes. If you're actually putting it on a show, if you're licensing it properly at least, you don't get to change like lines, like what people say or do, that sort of thing. Do you know if it's the same way for dance movements? Are those actually like inside of scripting in some cases?
There are some very specific shows or pieces that if you change the choreography, you lose a lot of the love of the audience. But it's not necessarily impossible. It's just kind of frowned upon. Like, for example, if I were to re-choreograph Swan Lake.
Right, right.
There are pieces in Swan Lake that are in that dance for a reason. And it's known as the most technical dance in the world for a reason. So if I were to re-choreograph it because I thought I could do it better, sure, I would lose the love of my audience. So I think when it comes to choreography, it's just more about what the people paying for the tickets are there to see.
I like the idea of that. It's like, Swan Lake, I'm over it. We're going to do something brand new here.
I think I can do better. How dare Tchaikovsky?
That's right. This is one of my favorite sequences, this entire Dance at the Gym sequence. But right now what's going on is that they're trying to make it so that different girls and different guys are going to start to dance with each other. We know this is not going to end well, but we are starting to form these two concentric circles that the dance master has asked them to do, and very sweepingly have brought on our two main couples here onto the dance floor.
And can we have a moment to just really appreciate how fantastic those two ladies can walk onto the floor? Just walking onto the floor, you stop doing everything and just want to watch them. It's incredible.
One thing we haven't pointed out here yet is that at least the character of Anita, who's kind of like the foil to Maria, who Maria is very chaste and pure and everything. Anita's kind of her supposedly exact opposite, played really, really greatly by this actress, Rita Moreno, who, if you don't know, is an EGOT winner. So she has like Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony, which is not easy to do.
She's basically a goddess. Yeah.
Yeah, she's phenomenal. And here in a moment, they're going to make him stop. And of course, they're like, no, we're not going to do this. I love that backing up and then the flourish here as they break off into their specific couples here again. And here I find that they're going to do something just a little bit different as the kind of two crowds part away from each other. They basically say mambo and they yell at each other. And then they start doing kind of like almost like a swing dance here going on.
Yeah, they it always kind of bothered me that they yell mambo and there's very little mambo.
They don't do any mamboing whatsoever.
Like they definitely started off and you can see that there's going to be a little bit of a Latin flair, which I really appreciate, but it's definitely not the style of the era. So they sort of leave it behind. And I wish that there had been a little bit more genuine mambo in the scene, but the dancers are absolutely incredible for the styles that they're doing.
Right. And then we have like, yeah, there's the Puerto Rican women here doing their kind of interesting, like, small movement sachets.
Yeah, they keep it definitely a little bit more cultural, for sure. And I love that they keep that throughout the entire thing. There's a great moment right near the end of this scene where they're doing almost exactly the same movements, but they just have a little bit of a cultural difference to it. So you can see the very American, almost uptight version of the choreography, and then you get to see the beautiful, loose hip movements from the Puerto Rican women that are exactly the same choreography, just done with a different flair. It's really beautiful.
I think it helps too, like the different styles of dress here as well. Like you have the Puerto Rican women who have a very flared out style on their dress, and then we have a much more slimmer fit on like the white girls.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting too, because we've been mentioning here on the show already just how intricate like the lyrics and the music is to show off that there's those different cultures. And this is, now that I'm rewatching this again, how obvious it is that they're doing the same thing with their dance movements. And that guy just showing off that he can do like a backflip.
Yeah, they always bring in the one guy who has to do a backflip.
That's
right. But even the idea of, there's a little bit of, just a few moments ago, we saw almost a little bit of a Paso Doble feel to it. And that to happen for the Puerto Rican side and not for the American side, it's just, it's very, very telling that they want to hold on to their culture. And it's a great idea in the choreography to just add a little bit of flair, just making their hips move slightly or for them to do different drops rather than flips.
Now, you just used the term Paso Doble. What does that mean?
Paso Doble is a type of partner dance.
Oh, I got you. Okay. That's really cool.
Yeah, and they just have little moments that you would normally see in like a competition Paso Doble.
Now things are getting a little bit more frenzied here as both sides trying to outdo the one another.
And then this is the moment where you can start to see that they look almost mirrored.
Right, yeah.
Where the kicks happen at the same time, the turns happen at the same time, they partner at the same time, but the Americans are a little bit taller, a little bit more uptight in the movements, and then the Puerto Ricans get a little bit more, we'll say grindy.
Okay, sure.
They kind of wind a little bit more.
They start to twerk a little bit.
Yeah, they basically just start to shake everything. Right. Yeah.
This is like a very famous scene in movie history where everything kind of blurs out and all you see is Tony and Maria on opposite sides of the screen, and then they eventually just walk towards each other, which I've always really enjoyed. You can definitely tell it's a dated special effect now at this point, but I still think it's very effective.
One of the best cute meets ever, absolutely.
Yeah, it's like just like right across the hall from each other, and we can see what the other person is doing. And this is like one of my favorite things as well, because it's the same music that's playing here right now, but slower, subdued, and I love how they use those little finger snaps that heard throughout the show already, but now in kind of this like dream lullaby sequence. It's a great
I've always kind of felt like the dancers in the background for this, it almost makes it seem like the blurry background when someone's fading into a flashback or into a dream in modern day television. They almost completely ignore the dancers in the background. You can't even really see them. They're in such darkness, but it just makes it seem so much more dreamlike having them in the background instead of just the two that are meeting.
Yeah. And with the background essentially going dark here, I like the way that it almost mimics the night sky there in the background as well.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, this is the essentially the first time that Tony and Maria have actually said two words to one another. Of course, all he learns is her name. He doesn't really learn anything about her.
That and he's never seen her before.
That's right. Which is all you need, basically, at that time to have an epic love story.
Well, that and a brother who wants you dead.
Well, that too, yes. I mean, that does add the drama in. Okay, we're going to pause it there for right now. So after having watched basically that entire sequence at the gym itself, I was actually curious about how, in the same way that when you're listening to music, even if you don't know how to explain it, there are major and minor keys. There's stuff that makes you happy. There's stuff that kind of makes you sad. Is there dance steps that do kind of the same thing or are meant to do the same thing?
I don't know if there are necessarily steps that are meant to do the same thing, but the way that they're executed definitely can. The transitions between really, really sharp staccato movement and flowing into suspended movement, that can really change the way that you're seeing something. So if I was to go on stage and do a really sharp and powerful jazz piece and then finish it off with a soft contemporary as my music gets really, really violent, that's not going to make any sense.
Right.
You're not going to have any emotional connection to it. But if I'm dancing out an entire contemporary piece, a lot of soft movements, maybe even a lot of really heavy grounded movements to a piece that sounds like maybe it's about addiction or something, you're going to really feel that and you're going to understand that. So it's about how it connects. So I agree completely with the passage that you read earlier about how dance is one of those things that kind of pushes the story forward a little bit.
Yeah, it's one of those things with when Jerome Robbins, I know, was developing this, there was a conversation right at the very beginning whether or not to open this up like every other musical is, with essentially a musical number explaining like, this is what this musical is about. And pretty much every musical does start that way after the overture. But in this one, he lobbied like, no, there has to be dance that opens up the show to let the people know in the audience that this is what this is about.
Yeah.
Which is why you have that. You have what they call the prologue, but it's really just them dancing, showing off their skills, those finger snaps and the whistling and the vocalizations that happen in there. And then they move into the song that kind of introduces, we're the jazz and this is what we're about. And this is what the story is basically going to be about from now on. Is there anything specifically that stands out to you in the choreography of that gym section?
In that one set, for me, the transitions are absolutely incredible. He finds a really fantastic way, especially going from the big, like the full scene where everybody is dancing to just the two of them being the focus. It's executed so well, and I haven't seen or met a lot of choreographers who can go from just intense, crazy, modern dancing, almost fruging while they're dancing, and going into something that is just right on the border of almost being ballet. It's so gentle, and it's executed very, very well. And the entire time you watch it, you're just expecting her to put on pointe shoes.
It's
executed perfectly.
What is fruging?
It's kind of like, if you've ever seen Austin Powers, it's kind of like seeing the Fosse style at the beginning.
Gotcha. Right. Okay.
So they have a lot of almost Fosse throughout the entire scene. And every time I see it, I just can't wait for one of them to jump into the monkey.
I just need a hat and then I can like play around with it and stuff
like that. And don't forget that cane. You need a cane.
That's right. I think the special thing about this, what this piece is really meant to do is essentially we have... Again, these two cultures, we can actually see that through dance, how they're kind of portraying that at this school. We have the two lovers meeting for the first time, and then that kind of short, like, little ballet sequence amongst them as they meet for the very first time. I would love to see how this is realized on stage more than just looking at it on film, because in film, you get to have, like, your visual tricks, and you can push in and zoom out and do all your special tricks, but I think when you have, like, the purview of like you're seeing everybody at the same time, I think it would probably slightly change exactly how you perform it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any insights into that or not.
I have actually seen it performed on stage a few times. And the most common way that I see the transitions, especially that one being done, is throughout the entire gym scene, they actually lose couples. while they're dancing. So you'll see lineups where people will be coming through and they'll be partnering up man and woman and they'll start dancing, but there'll be a few people who, as they partner up, they actually just walk right off the stage.
Nice. Okay.
So the stage just loses people as it goes, and they slowly work their way down to the more modern and ballet trained dancers, and they do the scene by themselves and then start building the stage back up and start bringing all the dancers back on. So that's the most common way that I see it. It's usually pretty effective. Have one couple in the middle of the stage doing flips, and everyone stares at them while everyone else runs off stage and hides in the wings.
Right.
It's pretty common.
That's cool. I love it. All right. I mean, thank you so much then for coming in here,
not
Christopher.
A problem.
I think this helps explain a little bit more about why we chose certain things and kind of what the theory is behind some of the dance moves in and of themselves. I want to give you the time here. If there is a way that people wanted to continue to follow you on the internet, is there a way to do so that's easy?
There is. You can be super, super creepy and just stalk me and find everything just like in with your own
this
superpowers.
This is what I do. So.
It is, and you're very good at it. Or you can also follow me on YouTube at youtube.com/ChristopherDS, where I run a comedy channel. You can follow me on Twitter at ChristopherD, and that's pretty much where you're going to get the most of me on there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much.
My pleasure entirely.
So great. Thanks for listening. Once again, if you have enjoyed what you just heard, then leave a review on whichever platform you listen to podcasts. It really does help for podcasts that are just starting out. You can also let your friends and family know about the show, especially if they are fans of musical theater and or Stephen Sondheim. A big thanks to the always great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. We'll be back again next week, but for now, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.